With us today is Dr. Jennifer Lundgren. She's an associate professor of psychology at UMKC who specializes in body image issues. Jennifer, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. David Kreets also here. He's a surgeon whose clinical focus involves facial plastic and reconstructive surgery at the University of Kansas. He's also a member of the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. David, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
And finally today, Dr. Edward Ferrier has been practicing since 1987 and specializes in facial plastic surgery. He's a past president of the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. He joins us by phone from Tampa, Florida. And Ed, nice day of you too. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, Ed, let's get an overview here. What are the big trends when it comes to facial cosmetic surgery? I mean, is demand growing? Is there any question about that?
There's no question demand's growing, and probably the biggest thing feeding the demand is the less invasive alternatives that are kind of available to hopefully delay, forestall the aging process, and then some of them are even appropriate for trying to turn the clock back a little bit. So that's been the biggest change in probably the last half decade.
And Ed, when you say less invasive alternatives, you're talking about what?
Things such as injectable fillers, Botox, or some variant of the botulinum toxin. There's several other manufacturers. And then the non-ablative resurfacing options, meaning you don't damage the skin as much, so there's a shorter healing time, fewer risk, fewer complications.
And what part of the face are we talking about? I mean, are we talking about areas around the eyes and mouth, or what are we talking about?
Well, you can treat almost everywhere. Certainly, anything that treats the surface of the skin can be used on the entire face, can even be used on the neck to a lesser degree, simply because neck skin doesn't heal quite as well as the facial skin. The fillers can be used to enhance the cheeks, to fill some of the deeper furrows or the dark shadows under the eyes. And then Botox can be used in the forehead, crow's feet or the corner of the eyes, and the deep wrinkles between the brow. So they're varying applications, and each kind of is specific to a given entity.
Yeah.
You can't correct anything with any one treatment, and unfortunately sometimes consumers have the impression that by getting fillers they're going to address the fine wrinkles in the age spots, or by getting Botox they're going to take care of the deep furrows. So there's a whole spectrum, and it's really a matter of seeing somebody who has a reasonable degree of expertise to kind of guide you through it and educate you on your options and help you make the best choices.
Yeah. Dr. David Kreets from the University of Kansas, to what extent is social media playing a factor here in people, you know, seeing more pictures of themselves online and wanting to make improvements, if you will?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I mean, all you have to do is walk anywhere in a public place and you see people with their devices out. And, you know, it used to be you'd ask somebody if you could take their picture. Now they don't want you to take their picture. They're busy with the selfie. And so patients and really all of us are constantly bombarded with images of our face. And I think the more we look at ourselves, especially when people are somewhat critical, perhaps on some of the social media sites, I think the more people are starting to pay attention to that.
Yeah.
So we really have seen, you know, it's not uncommon for me to have a patient that comes in that used to bring a magazine of a Hollywood star and say, this is, you know, this is what I'm after.
Really?
Yeah. Now what I find is that people bring in their cell phones and they show me a picture of their selfie that they either like or don't like. And sometimes, you know, what they're seeing in their selfie is not exactly what's really in real life.
Wow. Dr. Jennifer Lundgren specializes in body image issues at UMKC. What's your reaction to all this? I mean, are you surprised by this, or what do you make of it?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I've been really giving this a lot of thought because
ever since we invited you
since,
here,
yeah,
right?
Because
that's what happened.
You know, it was interesting when your staff contacted me. I thought, selfie surgery. I don't know what that is because I am used to, at least in the eating disorder and body image field, this more traditional notion that in society there's an ideal thin image. You know, imagine 30 years ago, before there were social media in the way that we have it today, a 14-year-old girl might sit in her room and read 17 magazine and look at the models and then start to, you know, have a discrepancy between her own self-image and who she, you know, probably isn't able to you know, become. In large part because of airbrushing techniques that we're now more familiar with.
Sure.
And so that's been the, you know, at least from a social science perspective, what people have been studying is how is it that we, you know, end up with this discrepancy between societal images of what beauty or youthfulness should look like and what we look like. And then at what point does that become problematic for a person? Mm-hmm. You know, at what point does a person's body image become so bad that they might develop an eating disorder or something called body dysmorphic disorder. So I found this interesting, and the more I started Googling it and looking into it, what's interesting about this is it's no longer the self versus other. It's the social self versus the real self.
Meaning what?
Meaning, you know, you're no longer comparing yourself to someone else and something that quite frankly was probably unattainable because it was airbrushed or that you might have to have a major surgery to achieve.
Right.
Where now, you know, as Ed Ferrier spoke about, the accessibility to the surgeries is so much, it's more accessible. Mm-hmm. It's not as invasive. And so now you have a scenario where the person is comparing who they are now to who they could be. And they can actually make those changes.
Yeah,
and so from that perspective, it's not surprising that there's been an increase in the number
of people. I got to point this out. You know, Dr. Crete, you were talking a few minutes ago about selfies and social media. And that makes me think about the cameras used to take those photographs. And there's been some research on this front as well, or at least some observations made by photography experts who point out the flash on those phones is pretty harsh. The wide angle lenses create a certain distortion. The quality is totally inferior to the kinds of pictures that other cameras might take. And so all of this rise, much of this rise in plastic surgery associated with selfies is based on a false premise to begin with.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we rely on when we're judging our results is standardized before and after photographs. And we're very careful to choose a lens that's not too telephoto.
I can imagine.
It compresses the face, or too wide angle, which makes the nose appear long, the face appear narrow. And so, you know, that's exactly what's happening with the cell phones. It does have a thinning effect on the face because of the wide angle lens. And so it's a distorted image. And the other thing I think that you have to think about is that the image that you see with the selfie is not the same image that you see when you look in the mirror. The images are reversed. And so, you know, it used to be that the mirror is where we would spend time to examine our faces.
Yeah.
And that still happens. But the cell phone gives us this different image that really is not reality.
Ed, do people understand that when they come in to see these different doctors? Are doctors explaining these sort of facts of life to people when they come in inquiring about the possibility of surgery?
Well, absolutely to the question that doctors should be, and I think most are, explaining the limitations of selfie photography and how that impacts your self-image when they're educating the patient. And as I mentioned before, it's really a matter of educating the patient about what's going on and what's realistic. And sometimes what they see in a selfie is not realistic. And the only thing that Dr. Crete didn't mention is, if you think about it, when you take a selfie, you're frequently in a odd or unusual position. Frequently you're looking down at the phone, which doesn't compliment anybody's face. And so you do have to educate them. And if they show you a picture in a selfie, typically there are some unusual shattering or distortion that you get from the lens itself that you do need to point out to these patients, and then use your own photography that's done professionally in the surgeon's office to show them what truly exists, and try to go through then the options that are available to improve their appearance.
You know, Jennifer, this is so interesting to me, all of this, because I was thinking, too, about sort of the age discrepancy when it comes to this topic in general, that, you know, folks 50 and above might think all of this is a sign of too many people with misplaced values, while younger people view this as, hey, this is a sign of the times, the world's changing, get with it, kid. And people look at this very differently depending on how old they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, when I was looking into this, just to educate myself, I came across a study looking at quality of life outcomes in people who had had facial surgeries, both to address normal aging and also to correct dissatisfaction with their nose. And it was the younger group, the people who were in their 30s, who were the least satisfied with the outcome, which I thought was fascinating because, you know, some of the stuff that I've read would suggest that it's the younger generation that is seeking out more surgery because they're doing more, they're taking more selfies, but that they might be, you know, at risk for fight if they actually have the surgery. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting.
You know, Ed, I also wanted to ask you before you go here one last thing. I mean, some experts say, again, based on what Jennifer is saying, that facial cosmetic surgery is the new makeup, meaning that in years to come, we'll all be getting surgery because it will be the norm, like wearing makeup. Do you agree with that, Ed, or is that where we're going here?
I don't think it will be the norm as long as surgeons are responsible in how they educate patients, because there's an associated risk with all of these things, with everything as simple as Botox, injections, or what we call neuromodulators, the fillers. They're not risk-free, and certainly, the surgical interventions entail a certain degree of pain and swelling and recovery and interference with your lifestyle. So I don't think it will ever replace makeup. It's certainly an alternative, and some of the things can help slow the progression of the aging process. Simple stuff, hydration, sun protection, those kind of things which I think most of us lecture to our patients about. And so, no, my answer to that would, I don't think it will replace makeup. I think it will become more popular as some of the less invasive alternatives become safer and more affordable. And one thing, you know, is there are certain market demands, and as a market for something gets big enough, someone will come up with a better way to do the same thing and make it less expensive. So it'll continue to increase, but it'll never replace makeup.
Dr. David Crete, do you agree with that, or where do you come down with that?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, most of the patients that I see come in saying, you know, I feel great, I'm active, I'm watching my diet, but who I see in the mirror is not exactly who I feel like. And, you know, so what most of the patients are seeking to do is not to have some dramatic change that looks unnatural. They just want to refresh their face, put a little bit of restoration back into their appearance. And, you know, the vast majority are very happy. I do think...
Are most of your patients, you know, under 40, over 40? How would you break it down?
It really depends on the segment that we're looking at. I think already, you know, the patients undergoing filler and Botox or neuromodulators are probably starting in their mid-30s through the 50s. You know, the rhinoplasty patient population tends to be a little bit younger, I would say as early as 18 to 20, but many on into their 30s. And I still see people in their 50s seeking out rhinoplasty. Yeah.
I want to thank Dr. Ed Ferrier for taking some time with us. Again, past president of the American Academy of Facial, Plastic, and Reconstructive Surgeries. Ed, thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it today. Thanks for the overview.
My pleasure. Thank you. And I hope you did some good educating the citizens in Kansas.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. All right.
Let me get our listeners involved here. If you want to be brave enough to call us and tell us if you're considering some kind of a surgery in the wake of seeing yourself in a selfie or on social media and you're not crazy about what you're seeing, give us a shout, 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. David, it's my understanding that you were one of the chairs for an Advances in Rhinoplasty course, rhinoplasty dealing with surgery of the nose. Tell us about that. What's going on that front?
Well, it was a fantastic course with almost 600 surgeons from around the world. Over 60 countries were represented. And this is sponsored by the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery, but involves facial plastic surgeons, plastic surgeons, you know, a number of different specialties. And what we do is really try to put together a program that addresses a wide range of topics on rhinoplasty surgery, new techniques, measuring outcomes. You know, one of the things that we did was a panel on the selfie concept, and you know, had a number of different people, a couple surgeons, people from the fashion industry, psychologists, really to try to sort out and tease out some of these different trends that seem to be happening.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of how popular is rhinoplasty these days?
It's still one of the most popular surgeries that patients undergo, and certainly if you look at the range that I mentioned earlier, the 20 to mid-30s range, that's where we see rhinoplasty probably is the most common procedure. But mm-hmm. in my practice, it's the most commonly performed procedure.
Jennifer, in your classes at UMKC, how upfront are your students about talking about their own perceptions of their own images of their body? What do they say about it? What kind of conversations do you have?
You know, most of my conversations are with my doctoral students, and so they tend to be a little bit more academic. But interestingly, you know, I study a number of things related to obesity and eating disorders, but the number one projects my students want to do are related to body image, because it's just such a fascinating concept and something that I think resonates with all of us.
Yeah.
You know, and even if you have a relatively healthy body image, there's something called normative discontent. We can all find something that we're not really thrilled with about the way
Normative discontent. Only an academic would
only
use
an
a term
academic,
like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's truth to it. There's always something that we can find that we're not necessarily satisfied with. And I think, you know, for those of us who are in this field, it's a real personal struggle, because we want to take a position of acceptance and promoting healthy body image across society, and not becoming obsessed with, you know, images that just aren't attainable. But at the same time, I think we all have something that we are dissatisfied with and struggle with.
Well, here's a loaded one for you, Jennifer. When the procedure is purely for, you know, vanity purposes, looking better, is cosmetic surgery a good thing?
That is a loaded question.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, it depends on your perspective. I mean, I think.
Of course it does, yeah.
You know, and I actually did give this some thought, too. I think that I can only give my personal opinion that if the person is relatively, you know, if they are psychologically healthy, they don't have a body dysmorphic disorder where, you know, they have a perceived defect that objectively someone might say it looks just fine.
Could you see photographs of some folks who have surgery after surgery and it just knocks you
exactly.
over?
Exactly. I think that's when I would become concerned and, you know, say there's something else going on here. You need to figure out why you continue to have procedures, but yet you're not satisfied. And so we need to talk about what it is, the other aspects of yourself that you're not satisfied with, that this is not going to correct.
Well, that's a good answer, because you're saying that most folks have something that they might point to that they would say, you know, in a perfect world, I would have this fixed or changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's for each individual person. They have to make that decision about why are they doing it? Is the timing right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, especially if someone has been focused on these selfies, take a break for a while. Take a month-long social media break and see if you still feel the same way. You know, I think of it as if I say the word elephant over and over and over, it starts to sound really weird. If I'm looking at myself over and over and over, I start to perceive myself in a way that other people don't. It's no longer objective.
Yeah. David, you're nodding your head. You agree with that?
Well, I do. I think, you know, one of the most important jobs of the surgeon is to really have a frank conversation with the patient and to try to understand what their motivations are. You know, just to go out and do surgery on every person that walks through the office door, that's the patients aren't going to be happy, the surgeon's not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. So really a lot of time is spent trying to understand the motivations. How long have they been thinking about this?
How widespread is that kind of philosophy, though, doctor? Because if you're discouraging somebody, you're saying, I don't want your money, go away, not today, I won't take your money.
Well, I think it goes back really a little more than that, because really at heart, even though these are cosmetic procedures that aren't covered by insurance, it's still about helping people and improving their lives. And so when somebody comes in, if they have a bump on their nose, but it's something that's been bothering them for 20 years, they're otherwise well-adjusted, they don't seem to have any other psychological issues, but they say, if I could improve this, I think it would really help. And day mm-hmm. in and day out, I see people who come in after they've had procedures, some of them very subtle, and it just gives them a different outlook. It really can improve self-esteem. On the contrast, somebody who's had multiple surgeries and is pointing out, a defect that can barely be detected, that's where you have to stop and pause and say, is this really the answer? And many times it's not. Many times it's counseling or some other type of help.
How often do you have people who come in who fit that latter category there?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the general population, the most severe form is body dysmorphic disorder, and it's probably 1% or so in the population.
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
And it's higher in the patient population seeking cosmetic surgery, so probably somewhere in 7 to 10% or as high as 10%. I think many of those are probably very mild cases. To see somebody with severe body dysmorphic syndrome where it's right there, it's obvious, that's pretty uncommon.
Jennifer, define this body dysmorphic disorder. What is that?
Yeah, so it's when a person either has a real physical defect, but they magnify it. So someone might say, sure, there's a little bit of a crookedness to your nose, but everybody has a unique nose. It's not that big a deal. But they become so preoccupied with it. They might be doing mirror checking throughout the day. They might stop engaging in activities because they want to avoid seeing people. So it has to cause some sort of functional impairment or severe distress, or it's an imagined defect.
Yeah. And David, you're saying about 10% of your patients might fit that category?
No, I think in my population, I'm always skeptical to say, because it does not seem to be that high in my population.
Yeah.
I think it's probably less. Now, it could be probably in somewhere in that range for the people with very mild cases, but they can still do fine with surgery.
Yeah, but you definitely turn people away sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me get our listeners again. We need some brave person or two to give us a shout. If you're considering plastic surgery, facial plastic surgery, why? Is social media maybe a factor in your choice? 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jennifer, do you think there's more pressure to look good today than maybe like 25 years ago before all this social media stuff? Because, these days, old friends can look you up on Facebook and check you out, and the dynamics seem to be shifting to me a little bit.
Yes and no. I think impression management has been with us forever.
Impression management.
Another
academic term.
It is another academic term. Yeah. Our attempts to control the way that we present ourselves so that other people will see us in the best light. I think we've been doing that throughout all of the different types of mediums. But I do think the social media is unique in that you get immediate feedback. So think about Facebook. You post a picture. I'm guilty of this. I do it with my children. I post a picture, and I am on there 2 seconds later wondering, did somebody like it?
So that's
one of the differences, I think, mm-hmm. that makes this unique, is because not only is it about your impression management, but that immediate reinforcement or lack thereof, depending on how quickly, how many people, who likes your pictures.
I was thinking about this because someone in the room, I'm not going to say who, is coming up on his 40th high school reunion, this fall. And it just occurred to me that you get curious about what your buddies are doing. You start looking for them on Facebook. And you want to present, I'm sure people are cognizant of that, they want to present a great image 40 years later.
I'm laughing because somebody else in this room has her 20-year high school reunion coming up in October. And so I've been thinking about the same thing. And especially, because now Facebook book is actually, at least for my high school, how we are inviting everyone to the reunion and connecting.
That's right.
And so it is. I think that is what's different than the past. It's still impression management, but it's intensified.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got you by 20 years.
I know you do.
David, do you want to weigh in here or not? Do you want to stay out of this conversation?
No, I think you know, you brought up an interesting point, and that is that many times we say the social media crowd is the under 30 crowd. And that's just not the case anymore. If you look at, you know, I have a 20-year-old daughter. She's on Facebook hardly at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's Snapchat, there's Instagram, there's the other things. But it's the parents, it's the grandparents who are on Facebook.
That's what they say, that where the usage is these days.
And I, you know, I can't tell you how many times people come in and say that exact thing. I'm heading to a reunion, wedding, you know, any number of events like that. And many times people just say, you know, I want to look as good as I can.
More men than women patients for you, doctor, or women, more women than men, I'm guessing, or how does it shake out?
More women than men, and I think that's pretty typical. If you look at the national statistics, probably somewhere between 15% and 20% of patients nationally are men. But that percentage is increasing.
Yeah. And why is that?
Well, I think, you know, for a number of reasons. I think, I have a number whose wives tell them they need to come in. But basically, it has to do with the fact that we have things like filler and Botox.
And what is filler? I heard that Ed talking about that. What is that?
So if you think about the lines on the face, we have several different types. We have the frown lines, for example, between the brow or the crow's feet when we smile. Those are dynamic lines. So those lines are caused by muscle movement.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the types of lines that can be softened with a neuromodulator such as Botox or Dysport. On the other hand, the folds, the lines that go from the sides of the nose down towards the mouth or from the corner of the mouth down towards the chin, the marionette lines, the nasolabial folds, those aren't caused by motion. Those are caused by loss of soft tissue volume, settling of the tissues, and those are things that are treated with a filler. So a filler is actually, in most cases, a hyaluronic acid gel. So it's the type of substance that's naturally found in the body.
Right.
It's injected to help plump up those folds to soften the folds. So two different things.
All this has never occurred to me, I got to admit. Terry from Kansas City, Missouri, we have a brave caller here. Terry, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead.
When I was 13, I had an accident. I got shot in my eye with a BB gun. My brother and me were having some fun, and it was a one in a million thing where I got shot with my eye open, and so the BB hit the bottom color of my eye.
Right.
So after surgery, the pupil I had a pupil in the center of my eye, and then I had an odd-shaped pupil in the bottom corner of my eye, which so I had two odd-shaped pupils in one of my eyes, and for 20-plus years, none of my coworkers had noticed it.
Huh.
You know, it was obvious to me, and so when I had glaucoma and I had to have my eye taken out and get a prosthetic eye, I came in with a patch over my eye for, you know, several weeks. Everyone was shocked because, you know, my story, no one for 20 years had even noticed it.
A great example, doctor, of somebody, you know, thinking they had an issue when maybe they didn't. I just got a few seconds left here.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time talking to patients who bring up concerns. And, you know, one of the, especially the younger rhinoplasty patients is, you know, make sure you're doing this for yourself, because the odds are your friends aren't going to notice if you don't.
Oh, that's interesting.
If you don't tell them. And they say, I don't want that. But there's oftentimes a little bit of disappointment when they really don't see it, but you can look at the two pictures side by side and clearly see the change. So we're always our worst critics.
We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Dr. David Crete with the University of Kansas and Jennifer Lundgren, an associate professor of psychology at UMKC. Great conversation. Thank you both for coming in.